Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jennifer Robbins from the Helen Keller Center. Tell me a little bit about the Helen Keller Center.
So, Canadian Helen Keller Center, we provide intervener services to individuals who are deafblind, as well as we have supportive housing and training centers to teach individuals who are deafblind skills in daily living.
So, are there any myths surrounding the condition of deafblind that you'd like to clear up?
Sorry, what was that?
Most people hear the term deafblind and they assume a complete loss of both vision and hearing. Can you speak any to this myth?
Certainly there are individuals who have a complete loss of their hearing and vision, but in most cases it's a varying degree of vision loss and hearing loss, and it can be different in every individual. So each individual has a different degree of vision and hearing loss, which means that communication can be different in various ways. So a lot of our staff have to be trained in various types of communication.
So what types of alternative communication do you use?
So we have individuals that would use American Sign Language, and then an adapted form of American Sign Language that is tactile, so like a hand over hand. Some individuals can hear voice. Some individuals we will do what's called a two-hand manual alphabet on their hand, which is various touch points on the hand represents a different letter of the alphabet.
And how do you go about teaching someone who's learning this for the first time?
Learning, do you mean like an intervener or for a deafblind person?
Both, actually.
So interveners, most of our interveners on staff come from the George Brown College Intervener Program. So that's a two-year program, as well as we do have some individuals who have an interpreter background who would train as some of the sighted guide and other deafblind-related skills.
So what's been the great... Pardon.
For individuals who are deafblind, they would learn communication, you know, as a child, our consumers are adults. So they would have learned in school or a family member.
So are there any challenges in the services you do provide?
Certainly, yeah. Our consumers are adults, so we have individuals who anywhere from 18 years old to in their 70s or 80s. Certainly when people are aging, that's been one of our most recent challenges at this time. A lot of our consumers who were, you know, young back when we opened up have now kind of aged in place and aged as consumers of our service. So that's been a challenge, certainly, you know, adapting our skills and the services that we provide to meet their needs.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the center, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
You know, certainly lots. I've been here for 23 years. I've seen deafblind people go through university and get their degrees. I've seen them out in the workforce. I've seen them have families, take on challenging adventures, walk the edge walk on the CN Tower, fly airplanes and things like that. I've seen quite a few amazing things in my career.
So when you mention the edge walk, can you fill me in a little more on the story that goes with that?
We have an individual who lives here in the apartment building. She's quite active out in the community. She's quite daring. She plays hockey with the ice owls. She's very active in terms of athletics and sports, softball, and that kind of thing. And she wanted to do the edge walk, and certainly, you know, that posed some challenges being deafblind and some concerns. But she was determined to do so and did it successfully.
So, what other remarkable examples can you share the story of?
You know, I have seen people who have graduated university. One of the first stories of some of the earlier services in Ontario was May Brown, who was the first person to graduate university. He was deafblind in Canada, and that was back in the 70s. Certainly, we've seen consumers do so since then. You know, and just some of the things that people can do when you don't have vision and hearing is remarkable. And I know individuals who have flown a plane, who go skiing. You know, there's really nothing that people can't do if you put your mind to it.
So when it comes to deafblind pilots, can you tell me how they might get certified for this, if you know offhand?
Well, I don't think it was a certification. I think it was more of just an opportunity to do something one day while they were out in an airplane, and you know, there was no certification, but it was something that someone, even like you and me, might not ever have the chance to do, but had the chance that day to do so and did.
So, if you could send any message to the community about why this work matters, what would you say?
I would say that individuals who are deafblind, with the support of an intervener, can do almost anything that anybody else can do, that you or I can do. And I think that, you know, people would think that if you have vision and hearing issues, that would be a challenge. But I think for some people in this community, it's quite the opposite. It makes them more more interested and more daring to do some of the things that might make other people afraid.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
The next segment of our show, we'll be chatting with Marcia Carroll from the PEI Council of People with Disabilities. So tell me a little bit about the council's work.
We're a provincial organization that works primarily with people with physical disabilities. So we provide services around community access. So we have a number of staff that help people with disabilities navigate various bureaucratic systems. As well, we do lots of work around employment. We run the council has an employment agency specific to people with disabilities. As well, we are the community coordinators for the Opportunity Fund for the province. So we have our own wage subsidy program, and we administer that for people with physical disabilities, people with mental health challenges, and people with intellectual disabilities. So we do lots of work with employers and job seekers and doing that matching and job coaching. We also run a summer tutoring program that does one-on-one counseling for learners within the kindergarten to 12 school system. And we do lots of policy and committee work with government, and we do advocacy work as well.
So when you mention employers and job seekers, what sort of employment barriers do you most commonly see in your work?
Well, that depends entirely on the person. I mean, first, the biggest barrier, or one of the main barriers certainly, is physical access. If you can't get in the building, you're going to be challenged to work there. The other ones are, are there supports for people with hearing impairments or visual impairments? What's the level of learning that needs to take place in order for the individual to secure the job, as well as, are the environments friendly to people with sensory disabilities or autism? So it's varied. It's a wide range of barriers, systemic barriers that exist. But ultimately, what we run is a client-centered service. So we work with each client, we help identify those barriers, and then we work around solutions with the client and the employer to remove the barrier. And that's very individualized. However, there is big systemic pieces that can happen to make our environment more inclusive, and that's using universal design when new construction's happening and businesses are open. This should be accessible to all job seekers and customers.
So, in your time with the council, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Well, I've been with the council for 12 years, so there's literally hundreds of success stories. One that comes to mind very quickly is through the summer tutoring program. We started working with a young man who had autism, and we were his tutor. So he accessed our program every year to be a tutor. And through that program, he gained significant confidence, significant communication skills. At one time, he thought he wanted to be a film producer. And as a result of being involved with summer tutoring, he changed his career path and said he wanted to be a teacher. So he came to us and said that he would like to be one of the tutors. He felt he didn't need to be tutored anymore. He wanted to do the tutoring. So we hired him to be a tutor and gave him a set of clients that we felt he would be successful with and working with, and he was extremely successful. So through his university career, as he studied to be a teacher, he worked every summer to be a tutor, and he's now running a special ed department in up north somewhere. I can't remember the community right off the top of my head. So he got his undergrad degree and his master's degree, and now he's working up north running in a high school that he runs the special needs department.
So, how do you go about reaching out to potential clients?
Our Our programs are client-driven, so we wait for clients to come to us. We do the regular advertising. We have Facebook pages. We network. Anybody we talk to, we often say, somebody will say to me, what do you do? I work with the Council of People with Disabilities. And then they'll start to talk about their child or their sister or their brother or whatever. It's normally a family member, and we'll say, well, tell them to give us a call. We make an appointment, we bring them in, we do a needs assessment, we identify which program stream that would best suit them, and we set them on their way.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for equal access and inclusion of people with disabilities, what would you say?
I would say that people with disabilities have the right to experience full citizenship like every other Canadian citizen, and that because you have a different level of ability does not make it okay for you to be isolated and excluded from society.
So, does the council work in partnership with any other organizations primarily?
Yes. Yes, we do. For instance, our community coordinating program that we do with the wage subsidy. So we would be working with employers through that piece of work. But we also would be working with the Canadian Mental Health Association because we would be funding some of their clients. We would be working with various organizations that provide services for people with intellectual disabilities like Tremploy or Community Connections, Inclusions East. And as well, we would be working with career development services that also provide some employment counseling to people with disabilities.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Peer Support Center is a free drop-in center where you Windsor students can find a supportive peer to talk to. It's a safe and inclusive space where trained peer support volunteers offer counseling to those in need. The Peer Support Center is located in room 291 on the second floor of the CAW Center and is open Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. For more information, call 519-253-3000, extension 4551, or email psc@uwindsor.ca. And remember, it's okay to not be okay.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Jennifer Robbins from the Helen Keller Center and from Marcia Carroll from the PEI Council of People with Disabilities.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jung Suk Ryu from Indefinite Arts. So what can you tell me about Indefinite Arts?
Well, Indefinite Arts Center is Canada's oldest and largest disability arts organization. We were founded in 1975, and today we support more than 300 artists living with developmental and or physical disabilities. And by supporting them, that means we provide artistic training opportunities, provide a platform for artistic creation, and then we have the great privilege of being able to showcase their work through exhibitions and presenting opportunities, both locally within Canada and also around the world.
So, can you tell me a little bit about how the community responds to the showcasing of this art?
I think it's pretty phenomenal, especially nowadays when I think more and more individuals are looking for that story behind the art and not judging art simply by its aesthetic value. We're now seeing audiences and viewers looking at our artists and realizing the kinds of barriers that they've had to overcome in order to produce that kind of work. And the response from the stories has been absolutely positive wherever we've been, including a number of foreign destinations where we were a little bit hesitant and not sure about what the response would be like in different parts of the world. But through it all, I think that's one of the greatest things about humanity is that we are drawn to each other's stories, and the same could be said about our artists' works.
So would your work include things like supporting quadriplegic or visually impaired artists?
That's right. Obviously, when we deal with numbers like 300, and those 300 artists access our space every week, although now we're providing support virtually, we have a whole range of disabilities that we have to understand and adapt to, including individuals with significant mobility challenges, as well as a number of artists who have vision loss.
So, in terms of mobility challenges, what sorts of supports do you provide to allow them to participate fully?
Well, at the heart of our programming, we talk about our program being self-directed, meaning that the artist gets to choose what it is that he or she wants to create. So in that process, we empower the artist to make those creative decisions, but we help facilitate that process by providing adaptive tools, for example. So we have different sort of table side clasps or opportunities for canvases to be raised up to meet the necessary height of somebody in a motorized chair, for example, or for individuals with very limited mobility and use of their sort of hands or have limited dexterity. We have different tools like using sponges to basically dab patterns on ceramics pieces or getting them to design different sponges and with the support of our facilitators. But every scenario, as you can appreciate, is so unique, and our team of facilitators really are there on standby all the time to make sure that we provide any kind of resource or support or adaptive support possible so that the artist can take control of their own creative agenda.
So, how would you go about supporting an artist with a vision impairment?
Well, I think the interesting dynamic is about thinking about visual art from the perspective of somebody who has vision loss. And in many cases, more often than not, we're actually learning from our artists who have vision loss rather than the other way around. Rather than us supporting them, they're telling us what they'd like to do and how they'd like to interpret things onto their visual pieces. So in many cases, without a doubt, tactile feedback tends to be one of the biggest sources of inspiration for our artists. So whether it's a crumpled piece of paper or some kind of fiber, they then take that feedback and show us how they actually interpret that feedback onto a visual media. And what we've seen in artists like Andrew Harding is that approach actually is inspiring artists who have vision, right? They're now thinking differently about visual art completely. And Andrew's been one of our artists that has been delivering workshops based on tactile feedback and tactile guidance and inspiration for visual art in workshops locally and more recently in a workshop full of professional artists in Guadalajara, Mexico. So that's a long-winded way of saying we definitely want to support them, but in so many ways, our artists with vision loss actually show us a few things or two.
So in your time with Indefinite Arts, what's been the greatest success you've witnessed?
I think the biggest thing that we're beginning to see is that there's a community of partners that look at our artists as bona fide artists. I can tell you that that wasn't always the case, especially even my time when I first started out with this role. There was a real belief that what we were doing was much more of a social service rather than providing an artistic platform. And so what that transition has allowed us to be able to provide are economic opportunities and income-generating opportunities through art. And so when we're talking about our artists being commissioned to do public art projects in partnership with our local municipality and earning thousands of dollars through that process, when we're talking about our artists selling their works online and at art auctions all over the world, we're talking about our artists actually making an income, earning an income from something that is so meaningful in their lives. And I think that's been one of the greatest joys of doing what we do.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
My friends, the truth is, how a person sees or hears or makes use of their limbs is not what defines the quality of their life. If art reaches us, it reaches us. If it affects our hearts, it affects our hearts. It makes no difference that someone might have used other senses than we would typically think of in order to create it. But the fact is, a person's life and the quality thereof is not limited to how they do things. It is more a question of what they do, how they choose to apply their gifts. And it's organizations like the Helen Keller Center who are working with the people that some among us might say have no skills or potential to bring to the table. But fortunately, there are those who are willing to look a little closer, to see beyond just the words, deafblind, to see how can we create an opportunity for this person? Do they have a mind that works? They do. Do they have hopes and dreams? Of course, doesn't everyone? Do they have a chance to change the world? Well, that depends on us, doesn't it? I mean, if you give someone the right tools, chances are they'll build something sooner or later. However, if we just say to people, that's it, there's nothing we can do with you, and we accept that glass ceiling, it's a loss to us all. But the fact is, we're denying them an opportunity, but we're denying ourselves a new way of thinking, a new way of viewing the world, and a chance to find out what human potential really amounts to. If people had simply accepted at every barrier that had ever come up, this can't be done, no progress would ever have been made anywhere. For the most worthwhile things in life can take sometimes hundreds of attempts. I mean, light bulbs didn't just fall out of the sky, you know. It took a question of someone having perseverance, patience, and a firm belief that something could be done. Why is it any different when we look at the potential of what a human being might be able to do? Locked in each of us, our gifts, skills, strengths, perspectives, and sometimes time and just finding the right words are the key to that. A lot of people would attribute just someone in their lives being there at the right moment to changing the course of things, giving them hope for the next day. Now, given the current climate of things, finding hope is tougher than ever, I think. Given that people are just losing patience, losing jobs, worrying about what's going to happen with tomorrow. But if we believe there's going to be a tomorrow, and there's going to be a possibility, and things will shine once again, we're one step closer to making that a reality. How can we look upon any beautiful work of art in life, or life itself as a beautiful work of art, and say, this is meaningless, this is hopeless, all this good exists, but I'm going to choose not to look upon it. I'm going to choose to be the cynic, the person who simply doesn't value the good things that exist, whether pandemic or not, whether people are using their senses differently or not. Is it not still a world we were born into, a world full of life and potential and hope? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week. Stay safe, everyone.